A White House that, just about any way you look at it, is a picture of turbulence, turmoil, and yes, chaos.
Oh, someone make it end, please. Make it end.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, and in Cottage Grove on Queso. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, in Maui, Hawaii on KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, in Palinville, New York on WLPP, Grand Rapids, Michigan's WPRR, New Orleans WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, Seattle, Washington's KODX, Red Bluff and Redding, California's KFOI, Round Mountain, California's KKRN, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on many fine affiliates, including the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, and Detour Talk, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. I'm a little bit out of breath, Desi Doyen, trying to just keep up with everything that's going on, plus the reporter from the AP called.
Oh, yes.
They're working on an election integrity story, I am told.
That's awesome.
Asking for some quotes there. So I'm running behind in every way possible today. So you're just going to have to float me throughout this show, as you do every day, Desiree. I know there is a lot going on. The utter chaos continues from this White House and everything surrounding it. And we will get to at least some of that. We'll see how much time we have for it. As frankly, I think we'd have to go to a 12-hour show at
just
this
to
point.
Keep up with what happens from moment to moment. I know.
So first, though, let's start with our way out of what I regard to be this national emergency that this country is now in. First step out, the 2018 midterm elections, in which Democrats hope to take back control of one or both chambers of Congress. First stop on that path turns out to be your home state of Texas, Desiree.
Well, you got to start somewhere.
Texas on Tuesday is where the first 2018 midterm primaries of the year were held. And even and we've now got some reported results of how things went for Democrats and Republicans alike on Tuesday. Even if much of even that is getting buried by all the noise surrounding a White House scandal, incompetence, corruption, and chaos. So let's try to not get distracted by all of that for at least a few moments here. Here is a bit of what happened on Tuesday in Texas. Women running for Congress surged to big wins, and Democrats smashed recent turnout levels in Texas in the first in the nation 2018 primary elections on Tuesday, giving Republicans a potential glimpse of what's ahead in the first midterms under President Donald Trump, according to the Associated Press. Energized and angry Democrats in Texas, where the GOP has dominated for decades, came out in force on Tuesday to surpass 1 million voters and to eclipse midterm primary participation totals unseen in the Lone Star State since 1994. Equally striking was the showing by women on the ballot. Of the nearly 50 women running for Congress in Texas, more than half won their primaries outright or advanced to runoffs. So the women did very well. at the ballot box.
Fantastic.
On Tuesday. What's more, at least three of those runoffs, which will be held in late May, will feature women going head-to-head with each other, including a key race for Democrats in their bid to take control of the U.S. House this fall. Not all women who are on the ballot in Texas, however, fared all that well. Kathleen Wall, a Republican megadonor and a self-styled female Donald Trump. That's how she refers to herself. In Houston, she pumped $6 million of her own money into her own race for Congress. $6 million. That's a lot of money for a House race. But she failed to survive in a nine-person field in that district despite outspending all the other candidates and having the backing of the Republican, Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott. Wall spent more than $4 million to win the second district seat, being vacated by GOP Congressman Ted Poe, according to Washington Post. But she appears poised to miss the runoff, with all precincts reporting as of Wednesday, Wall trailed the second place candidate there by 145 votes. So she could still make the runoff, basically, if one of the candidates does not get more than 50% in a Texas primary. Then the top two vote getters will go to the primary in May. So Wall
to primary runoff
to the primary runoff.
Okay,
yes, thank you. In May, and then whoever wins that runoff goes to the general election in November. So Wall could still make the runoff. Absentee votes are still being counted, but she already appears to have spent roughly $350 for every vote that she received. That's before even another costly election if she were to have to go to a runoff here, and then, of course, the general election in November. So people seem to be counting her out. We'll see how it goes with the absentee ballots. Her failure was also a potential warning sign, however, on the limits of Republicans going all in on Donald Trump this year. She had staked her candidacy on TV ads that told voters that there was little daylight between her and the president, and that didn't go over all that well, at least in her race in Texas.
I'm glad to hear that. I mean, so far, so good, because it's not completely decided, but yeah.
For all the talk of renewed Democratic energy heading into 2018, Texas Republicans also set a new benchmark for turnout in a midterm election. More than 1.5 million people voted Tuesday in the Republican primary for U.S. Senate, which was won by incumbent Ted Cruz. So that 1.5 number, that's just less than a 12% increase from the 2014 primary. So they saw their numbers go up on the Republican side. Not nearly as much as the Democrats saw their numbers go up. The turnout for Democrats was over 1 million voters. That was higher than any non-presidential year primary in 24 years in Texas. But please note that that 1.5 million that the Republicans had on that primary on Tuesday was still more than the Democrats got with their just over 1 million that turned out to vote on the Democratic side. So Democrats shouldn't get too excited about turning Texas blue, at least not just yet. Democrats did show up despite the long odds this November of ousting statewide Republicans like Ted Cruz. Many women ran in a record 8 open congressional races this year in Texas, two of which are up for grabs after longtime Republican incumbents abandoned plans for re-election amid scandal. For Republicans, the primary was a vivid exhibition, says AP here, of the Trump effect on GOP politics. George P. Bush, remember him?
Oh, yeah.
George W.'s nephew.
It's Jeb's, yeah,
Jeb's
son.
Right? He's the Texas Land Commissioner. He won a contested primary after he cozied up to Donald Trump, who once called his dad, Jeb, a pathetic person. So how pathetic is Jeb's son? And George W. Bush's nephew, even after all of those attacks on his own family by Donald Trump. And Jeb is not the only Bush that Donald Trump has attacked in recent years. Even after all of that, George P. still cozied up to him anyway.
Of course he did.
Those are the respectable Republicans of the Bush family that for some reason even Democrats have been approving of in recent approval polling of W, which is just remarkable to me. How easily Democrats seem to forget.
Well, not just that, but let's talk about how easily George P. Bush forgot that Trump attacked his dad. Those Bush family values.
They don't care.
Nope.
They don't care. Power at all costs. Ted Cruz, for his part, dismissed talk of a Democratic takeover this fall. He said, quote, left wing rage may raise a bunch of money from people online, but I don't believe it reflects the views of a majority of Texans. He told reporters, Democrats will have a tough time winning statewide races in November, despite the Trump effect. They have fielded little-known candidates against top Republicans in those statewide races. For example, Governor Abbott will face either Lupe Valdez, who was Texas's first Hispanic lesbian sheriff, or Andrew White, who opposes abortion on the Democratic side and whose father, Mark, was governor in the 1980s. They will head to the runoff in May. But while the Democratic Party got nearly double the number of votes it did in 2014's primary, the party itself faces divides in this upcoming May runoff. Increases in Democratic turnout were most pronounced in urban and suburban areas, where the party is hoping to reclaim House seats now held by Republicans. But that does not necessarily translate into wins in November, as races without a clear winner will be going to these runoffs on May 22nd and are already laying bare intra-party disagreements that we discussed last week on this show with Howie Klein of Down with Tyranny. For example, in the Houston area's 7th district, where incumbent John Culberson is seeking re-election and thought to be very vulnerable in a district that was won by Hillary Clinton in 2016, four times as many Democrats voted this year than they did in 2014. But that race has instead ended up showcasing divides within the Democratic Party itself between establishment-backed and more progressive candidates. Before the primary, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the DCCC, moved against one of those candidates, as we talked with Howie about, against Laura Moser.
An unprecedented move.
As far as I know, yeah, to attack a Democrat like that in a primary. They were claiming that she would be less equipped to defeat Culberson in the general election. Well, Moser ended up with 24% of the vote. She will go to the runoff. She is set to face Houston lawyer Lizzie Peniel Fletcher, who got 29% of the vote. So they're going to go to a runoff together. GOP operatives have been happily watching this drama unfold, the Washington Post reports. On Tuesday, the National Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, that's the NRCC, that's essentially the Republican version of the DCCC, they put out a new ad touting a Democratic civil war, highlighting the DCCC's Texas attack. Democrats fielded 111 congressional candidates on Tuesday, 111. That includes at least one for each of the 36 House districts in the state. That is more than 2.5 times the 41 candidates in the last midterm election back in 2014. Republicans also had more candidates than in 2014, but they failed to run anyone in four different Democratic-leaning districts. So in those cases where the Democrat won straight out, and I'll get to a couple of those races here in a moment, but where those Democrats won, then they're essentially going to Congress. There will be no runoff.
It would seem to validate Howard Dean's 50-state strategy back in the 2000s when he was chair of the Democratic National Committee. And he said, we need to have someone in every race, a Democrat in every race. So it looks like if you put somebody up, they got a pretty good chance.
The
of doing
voters will
well.
Come. Well, we will see. I guess we have to wait till November to see how that goes, but it's certainly a goosed turnout
for
the Democrats.
You can't win any election or any seat when you don't put up a candidate.
Washington Post notes that one trend was clear across the state. The best financed candidates, in several cases, could not buy themselves victory. That right there, I would say, may be very good news, not just for Democrats, frankly, but for American voters, period.
Yeah.
So drilling down a bit deeper here on the progressive Democratic side, as reported by Down with Tyranny's Howie Klein, who, as noted, joined us last week to discuss some of these Texas races where progressives were facing off against more conservative establishment Democrats in Texas. Howie also focuses on the failure of some of the big self-funded candidates as well, as the Washington Post does. Many of whom were supported by the very conservative DCCC, which is comprised of, let's say, moderate to conservative House Democrats who are trying to win back a majority there. So Howie reports that the biggest self-funder in the state, Republican Trump wannabe Kathleen Wall, we mentioned her earlier, in that open Texas seat in the 2nd District, didn't even make it into the runoffs. The Republican had spent $6 million of her own money, and she came in 3rd so far. At the same time, the biggest Democratic self-funder, guy by the name of Tahir Javed, also lost badly, didn't make it into the runoff either. So he says, don't you love it when plutocrats try to buy House seats and they go down in flames?
Yeah, I like that.
Well, you would, because you're just mean that way. The weirdest congressional race, he said, was that race in West Houston, the 7th District of Texas, where Laura Moser had been lagging in the absentee ballots. It didn't even look like she was going to be going to a runoff at all. And then she was savagely attacked by the DCCC, and everything turned around for her.
Gosh, it kind of backfired, didn't it?
Kinda, yeah, a whole lot. He says people hate the DCCC and their vile tactics so much that she jumped ahead after that attack, and she wound up beating the other progressive candidate that Howie's group, the Blue America PAC, had endorsed. That's Dr. Jason Weston. And he was a good candidate, by the way. World-renowned cancer doctor who said enough is enough. He's going to run for office, but it looks like he did not make it this year. She ended up beating the DCCC's own favorite, Alex Triantafylis, I think is how you say his name. Triantafylis, I don't know how you say it. So I'm glad that that he lost, because I could have never pronounced it. So this runoff is going to be between Laura Moser and who he describes, a candidate he describes as the anti-union Emily's List corporate Dem named Lizzie Fletcher. Organized Labor has already made it clear they're going to support Moser in this race against Fletcher in the runoff, and then again against the Republican Culberson in November. Over in El Paso, in the 16th District, the progressive candidate Veronica Escobar beat a corporate Dem self-funder by the name of Dory Fennenbach to replace Beto O'Rourke. He is taking on Ted Cruz for the U.S. Senate in November. He was a congressman, and now he looks to be the Democratic nominee for the U.S. Senate in the great state of Texas this year. The this particular district has a what they call a partisan vote index of Democrat plus 17. So it's a very Democratic district. There is no serious Republican challenger against Escobar, which means that Texas has just elected to Congress, in effect, its first Latina. She got more votes. She got more votes, more than 30,000. She got more votes than the Republicans in the race and Fennenbach, her Democratic opponent, combined. So no runoff in this race.
So she's
looks like she's going to Congress.
She's
going
to make it to November, and hopefully the turnout holds true in November as well.
I'm not even sure. Yeah, I guess she will have a someone she's going up against, but Howie says not a serious contender. Another district with no runoff will be Texas's 36th, which is east of Houston. Progressive Dana Steele trounced her Democratic opponent with over 70% of the vote. and will face off against who Howie calls the lunatic extremist Republican Brian Babin in November. In the Austin-San Antonio corridor in the 21st District of Texas, three progressives battled conservative ex-Republican Joseph Kopster. And Howie puts the word X in quotes as if to suggest that this conservative Democrat may still be more of a Republican than a Democrat, even though it now has a D by his name. But the runoff will include one of the progressives, Mary Wilson. She took first place with about 30% of the vote, and Kopser, the ex-Republican, came in second, so they will face off. The other essential race he cites is the 23rd Congressional District in Texas, stretching from San Antonio suburbs south along the Rio Grande to the suburbs of El Paso. The DCCC candidate Jay Hewlings, a blue dog and a new Dem, who is pushed by the Castro machine. You know the Castro machine in Texas?
You mean Mayor
Julian? Juan and Julio?
Julian Castro.
Yeah, the twin brothers.
Is mayor, the other's representative. I get them mixed up.
They're very popular among the establishment Democrats. They're both from Texas. Hewlings, who the DCCC supported candidate, came in third, failed to make the runoff, which will now consist of Gina Jones and a fierce Bernie-crat by the name of Rick Trevino. The winner of that runoff will face the mainstream GOP incumbent Will Hurd this fall. Another heavily Democratic district south of Houston's 29th district, where Democratic Congressman Gene Green is retiring. In effect, they also elected another Latina, Sylvia Garcia, who pulverized Tahir Javed. He's the one who had spent some $800,000 of his own money in this race. And there is no serious Republican challenger in that very Democratic-leaning district, which I think Hillary won by about 20 points. So that is now two Texas Latinas who appear to be going to Congress in 2019 for the first time.
So it's possible that Texas cannot have just one of its first Latina Congress people ever, but two
at the same time?
What?
I know. We will see. Garcia took 63% of the vote over the self-funder guy, the Tahir Javed. He only got 20%. She got 6, so she beat him 63-20%.
Wow.
And he says the last race we're following north of Desi's former hometown of Dallas in the 32nd district had 7 Democrats vying to challenge Pete Sessions in a district that gets a little less red by the day. Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton narrowly beat Trump there. The top two vote getters are Colin Allred and Lillian Salerno. The progressive blue America-backed candidate, that's Howie's PAC, Lillian Salerno. Both worked in the Obama administration. He says Salerno is more the progressive and Allred is more of the moderate. The heavily funded establishment candidate, a Hillary Clinton person named Ed Meyer, he came in fourth.
Hmm.
So women did well. Progressives did well. Establishment and self-funders did not do so well. Democrats turned out in record numbers, though still not large enough numbers to necessarily win statewide races in the Lone Star State. But we'll see. We've got a lot of havoc and a lot of chaos and a lot of disaster scheduled by the Trump administration.
Oh, yes.
Between now and then. So a lot can still change. We'll also have to see if Democratic voters are smart enough to come together even after what could be bruising runoff races in Texas, with progressive candidates facing off against more conservative Democrats who are likely to be supported by the DCCC. So, for example, will the DCCC do more of what they did last week when they attacked Laura Moser in Texas in the 7th District with what will almost certainly be used, whatever they attack her with will almost certainly be used by her Republican opponent this November, if she's lucky enough to win.
Yeah, it's a very, very dangerous and sensitive place to be. You know, on the one hand, it's good to work out those differences now. But on the other hand, as you say, depending upon how the DCCC decides to play it, they could severely damage whatever candidate ends up winning.
This is what primaries are for. You're supposed to have it out. Karl Rove developed the idea that you're not just supposed to oppose your candidate, you're supposed to destroy them. And I'm none too happy to see Democrats sort of picking up on, Karl Rove's tactics that have really become the way our elections are run now on all sides of the aisle. You can't just beat your opponent. You can't challenge them. You can't go out and say my positions are better than yours, and here's why. You have to destroy them. And for the DCCC to play into that seems kind of dumb. I'm hoping that the blowback that they received after attacking Moser, who probably would not have made the runoff at all had it not been for this attack by the DTRIP and this response from progressives who were angry about, you know, Washington Democrats coming in and intruding in our Texas elections.
Yeah.
But we will see. As to the problems at the polling place and the accuracy of any of the results being reported so far, well, much of Texas uses 100% unverifiable direct recording, electronic or DRE, usually touchscreen systems, though in Texas, most of them use a little dial, a little cursor wheel instead of a touchscreen, but they are equally unverifiable. In those cases, the reported results from those races, for example, in Houston, Harris County, where I believe they still use those 100% unverifiable machines, we will never actually know who won any of these races, who won or lost. We have to take the computer's word for it. There were a number of reported problems with, as usual, with both electronic voting systems and electronic poll books, as well as confusion after polling locations had been changed in a number of areas for some reason. And as I often note, most of the worst problems and the concerns about results don't necessarily come to light until the days and weeks after an election. I always have to remind folks of this after Election Day. Sometimes we hear about them. As is usually the case, corporate media helps to downplay any such problems as little more than hiccups, glitches, snags, and snafus. You know, nothing to worry about. Just a glitch, just a hiccup, just a snag, even though they often result in voters not being able to vote, not being able to participate in their own democracy. To me, those are not hiccups and glitches and snags and snafus. Let's take a quick break here. We'll come back with some of those hiccups, glitches, snags and snafus out of Houston, and then we will return, if we have time, to some of the Washington, D.C. chaos, because I guess I'm a glutton that way. I'm Brad Friedman, your glutton, and this is your Bradcast.
Trouble, oh, trouble set me free. I have seen your face, and it's too much for me.
Yes, it is. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. As usual, a number of voters, we don't know yet how many, had problems on Tuesday thanks to the terrible voting systems used across much of the state of Texas. And as I noted before the break, you know, corporate media just sort of plays along with election officials to downplay these things. It's just a hiccup. It's just a glitch. It's just a snag or a snafu. And but what happens is people don't get to vote. I consider it much more than a hiccup, a glitch, a snag or a snafu when a voting system means that someone cannot cast their vote or that vote does not get counted. I consider that to be a disaster, frankly. Now,
well, that's disenfranchisement.
Yep. And we don't yet know. It always takes a while for the details to come out about how bad things actually were. So we've just got a few examples here, some of these problems and the media downplaying it. For example, in Houston, The Chronicle reported on Election Day in an article headlined, "Few Problems in First Hours of Harris County Primary Voting." And then they went on to list a whole bunch of problems, which is how these articles were. I mean, you can search on Election Day or the day after election, search for the word hiccups, glitches, snags, and snafus, where they'll downplay these problems and then they'll tell you how they are. So here's just a few of them. Let's see. As of 11 a.m., a little bit after 11 a.m., the line extended out through the doors of a tucked away building at the First Baptist Church in the Heights on Tuesday morning after an hour of headaches getting the voting machines going. A poll worker at the Democratic precinct said the machines on one half of the room were operational by 7:20 a.m., but the other side of the room wasn't up and running until nearly 8 a.m. So that's a full hour of voting. So for people who have to, you know, work during the day, that's a full hour of voting. They may not be able to stick around for that extra hour.
Yeah, if you've ever driven in Houston, you know the traffic is insane. It is one of the worst places to drive in the nation. So if you can't get in,
and that's coming from someone who lives in Los Angeles.
Yes, so, that's true. So, you know, it's really bad. If you cannot get in, then you have to leave by a certain time just to be able to get to work on time.
And by 11, this is actually 11:18 a.m. This is time stamped from the Chronicle. There was still a line extending out of the door, even by 11:18 a.m. in a primary election, which is, much lower, even though we had big turnout from both, especially from Democrats, but also from Republicans. But that's by way of comparison to previous primary elections. So if they're having that much trouble on a primary, if the line is extending out the door at 11:20 a.m., in a primary, what are we going to be looking at in these runoffs? What are we going to be looking at in November? It's shameful. By noon, they have another item here. Alice Marin showed up to vote on Election Day, but her plans were derailed when she learned that her polling location had changed. She was one of dozens of people at the Ripley Neighborhood Centers in the East End who were directed to other polling sites once they showed up, according to an election judge. Marin, who is 76 years old and uses a cane, said she wanted to vote for Sylvia Garcia for U.S. Congress and the Democrat who's running for the U.S. Senate. But now she said, they report she won't cast a vote. She said, "I don't have transportation over there," to the other polling place where they had apparently moved her polling place to. "I don't have transportation over there," she said, "so I'm not going to vote. I can't get on a bus because of my feet and I don't drive." Just a few problems reported in Harris County.
And this is just in Harris County.
Yeah, this is just Harris County, just in one precinct, just a few of these precincts here. Another voter at that same precinct expressed similar sentiment early in the morning, saying he had taken the bus and wouldn't be doing that again to get to his new polling site, according to poll workers. A volunteer at the precinct, however, offered him a ride, which he accepted. Jael Cassiano, an election judge at the site who saw the exchange, said, "Unfortunately, we've had to turn away a lot of voters. It's discouraging a lot of people from voting." Cassiano said 46 voters had cast ballots by 11:30 that day, and the precinct had turned away a total of 35 voters
nearly
who came to the wrong location.
Wow.
And a handful said that they did not think that they would vote. Joaquin Sarez, 70 years old, encountered Cassiano, the election judge, in the parking lot where she was assisting a curbside voter. Sarez, a retired welder, sat in his idling pickup truck. He said he was trying to find his location since he hadn't been able to look it up online. A few minutes later, David Vargas, 63-year-old, came down the stairs saying that he, too, had come to the wrong place. He lives about four blocks away, was unsure how to find his new polling location. He said, "I just wanted to vote. I'll have to find out where it is." What the hell is going on that they're failing to reach that many voters in the state of Texas to tell them where their polling place is? You know, they require in Texas This strict photo ID, voter ID, when you go to vote. The voter has to come up with very specific things, but the folks who run our elections, they can't even be counted on to reach registered voters and tell them where their polling place is. Election judges at the Four Points by Sheraton, at the Four Points, it's a hotel, Four Points by Sheraton, told the Chronicle earlier in the afternoon that multiple voting machines on the Democratic side, and only apparently on the Democratic side, were not working. And said the room assigned to the party was significantly smaller than their counterparts. At nearly 2 p.m., an equipment snag slowed voting at the Monte Beach Community Center. This was, and they describe it as a minor problem that an official with the Harris County Clerk's Office said should not have actually stopped anyone from voting. Precinct Chair Don Quintero, however, said that the long lines at the precinct were because both of the electronic poll book machines were installed incorrectly, thus meaning there was no backup for voters to use. Of course, they could have just signed in on paper in a poll book, but we have to make everything difficult when it comes to elections for some reason, especially in Texas, but many other states as well. We have to have electronic poll books. Just add something else, another moving part that can go wrong on a mission critical election day. There are no do-overs in elections. State Senator Sylvia Garcia waited in line for about an hour and 15 minutes when she was finally able to cast her ballot. She's running. She was running in the Democratic primary for the 29th congressional district. So even the candidate had to stand in line for an hour and 15 minutes first thing in the morning. She said she'll be filing a formal complaint so similar polling issues don't happen again like that. She said one voter not being able to vote because of this hiccup is too much. She said it's unacceptable. And again, remember, this was only for the primary. Imagine what will happen in the runoffs and in November.
Yeah, it depends on whether or not elections officials in Texas are paying attention to this huge red flag, this gigantic flashing warning sign that says, hey, get your act together.
This is not a warning sign. They are all fine with this. A few problems reported by Harris County elections officials. Remember, it's not a problem. It's a problem for you if you're one of those voters who does not get to cast your vote. It's also a problem for you if your vote is not counted and counted accurately. But we can't know because in Harris County, they use 100% unverifiable electronic voting systems. All right. So moving on to other chaos, that's who's next week? We'll see. I think there's an actual U.S. House special election next Tuesday in Pennsylvania.
Oh, right.
And whatever other nightmares await us, no doubt we will cover them next week. Meantime, on yesterday's show, we started off the show in the morning talking about Donald Trump's tweet saying that there was no chaos in his White House. Remember that?
Yes.
And then
that was
we
like
went
a thousand
on,
years ago.
Yeah, I know. And then we went on the rest of the show to talk about all the chaos that was happening just yesterday alone. Well, that tweet, in case you forgot, he said, people will always come and go, and I want strong dialogue before making a final decision. I still have some people that I want to change, always seeking perfection.
Is that what that's
called?
That's
what he said, yeah. There is no, and now we know that there weren't people he wanted to change. It was people who wanted to quit, namely his top economic advisor, Gary Cohn. In any case, he said, there is no chaos, only great energy. But that tweet was just the curtain raiser, as CNN describes it, for a certifiably chaotic day. In Trump's presidency, a top aide was found to be in violation of a major ethics law. That was one of the stories we didn't get to cover. We'll try to hit it now real quick. Of course, his top economic advisor, Gary Cohn, quit. And then after we got off the air, the chaos continued. Donald Trump was sued by a porn star and his administration sued the state of California in a widening fight over immigration. Other than that, no chaos.
It's all going just fine.
It is.
Well-oiled machine.
CNN also reported that Trump appeared to be sowing discord within his own current ranks. He gave permission to the Now, one of the five now former communications directors, Anthony Scaramucci, gave him permission to go out and attack his own chief of staff, Donald Trump's own chief of staff, John Kelly. And he has ordered John Kelly, reportedly, to figure out how to push his own kids, his own son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and daughter, Ivanka Trump, out of the White House. Why? He can't just fire them. I don't know. But
well, I think I know why.
Other than that, why?
Because he's a coward.
Oh. Other than that, no discord. So we had missed Kellyanne Conway. We didn't get, so let's hit her real quick. The U.S. Office of Special Counsel. This is different than Robert. This is not Special Counsel Robert Mueller. This is a specific office called the OSC, Office of Special Counsel. They announced that White House counselor, whatever that means, whatever she does, Kellyanne Conway, had violated the Hatch Act by, quote, advocating for and against candidates in last year's Alabama Senate special election while she was on cable news. Now, you cannot do that. If you're in the federal government, if you're working for the federal government, you cannot, in this case, stand in front of the White House as a White House official and say, go vote for Republican Roy Moore in the U.S. Senate. So she just blatantly violated the law. She apparently did it twice, according to the Office of Special Counsel. She violated the law that forbids officials from engaging in political activity in their government capacities with those comments that she made in television interviews last year about the Alabama's U.S. Senate election. The report was sent to President Donald Trump, and it will now be up to him, according to the Hatch Act, according to the law. It'll now be up to the president to decide what, if any, action to take against Kellyanne Conway, one of the few advisors brought on early in the administration that has yet to be fired or yet to quit. But now it's up to him what, if any, punishment to give Kellyanne. She's a close aide. She managed his. She was one of the managers for his 2016 presidential campaign. The White House, of course, disputed the findings of the Office of Special Counsel. Kellyanne Conway did not advocate for or against the election of any particular candidate. The White House said she simply expressed the president's obvious position that he have people in the House and Senate who support his agenda. Kerner. He's the special counsel here. Kerner determined that she broke the law during two different interviews, one on Fox, one on CNN. She appeared in her official capacity as she boosted the candidacy of Roy Moore, Republican Roy Moore, and discussed why voters should not support his Democratic opponent, Doug Jones. Kerner said in the letter that during both interviews, she impermissibly mixed official government business with political views about candidates in the special election, right? In the Alabama special election. It is the second time that Conway has been found to violate federal ethics laws through her public statements. You'll recall back in right after they took office, February of 2017. The Office of Government Ethics at the time said that Conway engaged in a clear violation of the prohibition against misuse of her position when she boosted first daughter Ivanka Trump's fashion lines.
I remember that.
She said, quote, go buy Ivanka's stuff. She literally said that in a Fox News interview. She said, I'm going to give a free commercial here. Go buy it today. Everybody, you can find it online. You're not allowed to do that.
Well, you're not allowed to do that, but if no one is holding anybody accountable for any of this, then it doesn't matter.
Do whatever
you want. The line has been obliterated, and if the corporate media isn't going to turn this into something to hold anybody literally accountable for anything or even ask them more than one time about it, then I don't see how this ever changes.
Walter Schaub, the senior director at the Campaign Legal Center, he was until recently the director of the Office of Government Ethics. He's the one who found that Conway violated ethics guidelines with her free Ivanka Trump commercials. He said the White House cannot continue to have one standard for the federal workforce generally and a lower standard for appointees who are close to this president. So that's why this is important. Not only because Kellyanne did it and was caught doing it, But because it sends a message to any and all federal employees in all the federal agencies down in the workforce that they can use their office to advocate for political policies and for candidates for office, even though it's a violation of the law. If Conway isn't punished, why should anybody else be? And even after a second such instance, by the way. So, you know, why do you think anybody else in this entire administration is going to face any type of consequences for similar actions? Okay. Yeah, I know I'm running late, ain't I? I mentioned that Trump's economic advisor, Gary Cohn, had resigned in the wake of disagreements over Trump's decision to move forward with aluminum and steel tariffs on those imports on aluminum and steel. Well, CNN reports that in the days since Trump's surprise announcement about those tariffs, Gary Cohn had worked quietly to soften Trump's decision and to try to convince him to backtrack. And this was a campaign that even Republican leaders, Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan on Capitol Hill, they've all been trying to get him to back down on these tariffs and the ensuing trade war that will follow. But Trump learned of Cohen's efforts to try to convince Trump to go the other way, and he became angry and made that clear, apparently, in the last 24 to 48 hours. Trump was surprised to learn that Cohen was working to arrange a meeting with representatives from the automobile industry and the bottling industry in an effort to demonstrate the effects that these steel and aluminum tariffs would have. The president has said he's not interested in such a meeting. He did not want to meet with these people from this industry, and he grew angry at what he saw as an attempt to deter him from his plan. And so remember, this is the guy who said on Tuesday, "I want strong dialogue on every side before I make a decision."
Oh, my goodness.
And yet he was angry.
Yeah, he doesn't want
apparently information from his own top economic advisor or from the industries that would be most affected by this global trade war when that was brought to him.
Yeah, he doesn't want any more facts.
No, he doesn't. So he's pretending, he's lying when he says he wants strong dialogue on every side. Yeah. In any event, the Dow futures quickly plummeted on Wednesday, as we predicted they would on yesterday's show. The Dow plunged more than 300 points at one point on Wednesday, but recovered a bit after Trump finally said near the end of the day that maybe he wouldn't include close trading partners like Canada and Mexico and the EU in the tariffs. He had previously insisted that these tariffs would be across the board, that they would be long lasting. And so finally he is maybe seeing the light.
Well,
and
he's
said,
just,
well, maybe we'll be a little bit more narrowly tailored here.
Keyword here is maybe.
Yeah. Although, you know, maybe he's going to do no tariffs at all. Since he said that, I, you know, didn't believe a word he had to say. All right. Two more quick ones before we get to a break here. Let's see. Okay. The lawsuit filed by the porn star known as Stormy Daniels. That happened after we went off the air. She claims that Trump never signed a hush money agreement regarding an alleged sexual encounter between the two of them, and therefore the agreement is void. She wants to tell her story now. Trump's lawyer instead, personal lawyer Michael Cohen and a business partner, he signed on to the agreement instead. Daniels, whose real name is Stephanie Clifford, has claimed to have had an affair with Trump several years prior to his presidency and was paid some $130,000 to shut up about it in the days right before the 2016 election, amidst multiple women coming forward to share their own stories about alleged encounters that they had, sexual encounters that they had had with the then Republican presidential candidate. Cohen intervened in this mess, tried to keep Clifford from coming forward. That worked for a while, but the lawsuit says that Cohen has continued his attempts at silencing Clifford, including as recently as February, just last month, February 27. Cohen has said that Trump vehemently denies any encounter between him and Clifford. And we also learned over the weekend, by the way, that Cohen had complained. He's claiming that it was his money. Donald Trump had nothing to do with it. It was his money. this $130,000. But we had some reporting over the weekend, I think, losing track of time here, that Cohen had complained after the election that he had yet to be reimbursed for that $130,000 that he gave to Clifford. Reimbursed by whom, Mr. Cohen? One more. This is another example of the Trump administration's never-ending battles. The Trump administration itself has now filed a federal lawsuit against the state of California and its top officials on Tuesday night to stop a cluster of so-called sanctuary state bills. By the way, I should say it's only fair that Trump is suing the state of California because the state of California has successfully sued the Donald Trump administration many times, so it's only fair. This latest suit is the this lawsuit is the latest broadside from the Trump administration against so-called sanctuary cities, a term referring to localities that abide by some measure of non-cooperation with federal law enforcement immigration officials. And that, they say, is in no small part because if, for example, people who are undocumented immigrants come in to report a crime and those people then get reported to the federal authorities for deportation, that's going to keep people from coming in and reporting crimes. Yeah. And it's going to make those people in immigrant communities a target.
Yes, much more vulnerable. It's a chilling effect.
All right. I had more detail I wanted to get into on that. Probably can't do it today. Looks like there's some other breaking news that we will hit after this break, if we have time. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. It's the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Okay, looks like we've got some bad and some good news here. Let's start with the bad news so that we at least finish off with a little bit of good news here at the end of our show. Police say, and this is just sort of breaking, so I don't have details on this, but from AP, they are reporting, they reported about an hour ago that two students had been shot in what they describe as an accidental shooting at an Alabama high school. That was, and one of those students had life-threatening injuries. I don't know. I think that makes our, 19th, 20th or more school
like
shooting this year.
Yeah.
We now have word from AP via the police that a 17-year-old girl, one of the two victims there, has been killed in an accidental shooting at that Alabama high school. Don't have too much more on it now. That's the bad news. This, I think, is good news just breaking. This comes from Reuters, reporting that Florida state lawmakers gave final passage on Wednesday to a gun safety package that raises the legal age for buying rifles in the state of Florida, and imposes a 3-day waiting period on all firearms sales, while also allowing the arming of some public school personnel. The bill was spurred by the shooting rampage 3 weeks ago that left 17 students and staff dead at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, and led to an extraordinary lobbying campaign by the young survivors. But the legislation, while containing a number of provisions that student activists and their parents had embraced, left out one of their chief demands, a ban on assault-style weapons like the one that was used in the February 14 massacre. Nonetheless, the National Rifle Association was strongly opposed to raising the age limit for the age minimum, I guess, for buying rifles in the state of Florida. And the very Republican state legislature in Florida, nonetheless, appears to have stared them down and passed not only an age increase that you have to be 21 to buy these deadly weapons of mass destruction, But also imposes a 3-day waiting period in Florida on all firearm sales.
Which is kind of a, I mean, I know it's just baby steps, but for Florida, these are very big baby steps.
These are huge, yeah.
That would defying the NRA like that, especially since the NRA had said that Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, was their number one A-plus favorite governor of all time.
Yeah.
For all of the ways that he has expanded access to guns and expanded just the number of guns in Florida.
But, of course, he's running for, he will probably run for the U.S. Senate in Florida this year. And these measures are wildly popular, even among NRA members, if not the NRA leadership. So, you know, that's some very good news. And I would say that it would not have happened, most likely, had it not been for the fierce advocacy of those kids at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas.
Oh, hell yeah. So, and I think those kids at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas are also a signpost of, hey, look what happens when you fund education, when you fund good schools with comprehensive extracurricular activities that make sure that kids are well-rounded. And, well, I guess that's why Republicans don't want to fund education, because then you get kids who are civically engaged.
So chalk one went up today, at least for the good guys. Way to go, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. You made a difference already in the state of Florida.
They've turned their grief into action.
I tell them, hey, keep going, but I have a feeling I don't need to tell them that. All right, we got to get out. They know. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. My thanks to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is our great honor to have you here. Thank you. If you missed any portion of today's show, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. You can drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. I've had a number of good listener mails that I've been trying to get to this week. Yeah, we'll see if I ever get there with everything that's going on.
Yeah.
But that's bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am simply TheBradBlog. And our thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate. To sign up for a subscription of any amount you like to help us continue to stay on your public airwaves and talk about the stuff that, frankly, most people do not get to hear in this country over our public airwaves. That's bradblog.com/donate. All right, that's it. I'm out of here. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.